Hey everyone, Blitcrash Priddle here, and it is awesome to be back on the medley once again after another long break. This time I'm going to be speaking with Deborah Drakeford, a Canadian actress who used to live in my hometown, Espanola, Ontario. She's best known for her role in A History of Violence with Viggo Mortensen, and she has also worked in Sailor Moon and Polka Dot Shorts. Alongside being an actress, she is also a teacher. And another thing that we have in common is that we both went to Espanola High School, and we took part in Espanola Little Theater. Before pursuing a career in acting, what was life like growing up in Espanola, our hometown?
I love that we both grew up in Espanola. I am not originally from Espanola. I was born in England, and then my family emigrated first to Quebec, a couple places in Quebec. And then when I was 9, I lived in Espanola. And I lived there until I was 17. So formative, very important years. And I love Northern Ontario. I loved Espanola. I consider it my hometown, even though I didn't spend my entire growing up time there. I love all the water. I love the rock. I love being in the heart of the Canadian Shield, and I love all the trees and all of that. But Espanola was also where my love for theater really began. My dad was a United Church minister, and my mom was a gospel singer, so, you know, that kind of performative arts is not far away for me as a kid. So I was doing plays with my mom in the church and that kind of thing. But it was when I hit high school in Espanola that that world really opened up for me, and I knew I was hooked. I remember in grade 9 sitting in the audience with my then boyfriend, lovely Derek, and sitting in the audience and watching the high school production of Grease. And I sat there and I looked at Derek and I said, I'm on the wrong side, meaning I should not have been in the audience. I should have been up there. And so the next year I auditioned, and that's where it all kind of opened up for me.
Was Espanola Little Theater a source of inspiration as well? Because that's a big, theater company in the town.
When I first started, I wasn't fully cognizant of Espanola Little Theater, but Bob Sproul, husband of Sharon Sproul, was in my remembrance. He was the vice principal of the high school at that time when I was there, and so Bob and Sharon were really influential people for me, mentors again, and so I learned through Walter and through Sharon about Espanola Little Theater. I only did one show with ELT. It was The Pirates of Penzance. Yeah, that was thrilling. And I would have loved to have done more. But then my dad got another job, and I had to heartbreakingly move from Espanola. I was not ready to go. I was in the middle of high school. I still had 2 more years of high school to go, and I would have loved to have just continued on with ELT and also with Espanola High School Drama Club as well.
And you mentioned a while ago that you saw the high school production of Grease, the Espanola High School production. I went to ABLS mm-hmm. Public School, and we did a adaptation of Grease as well, and I was Coach Calhoun because I was the tallest, so they needed somebody to play an adult. So it's such a crazy coincidence, isn't it?
That's so funny. Our stories just keep converging, don't they? Or meeting up at any rate. Isn't that funny? And yes, bless, you know, back in high school, bless all of you students who were like just taller, or, you know, you got to play all the old people. I was this tiny little thing, so I got to play all the young people. I didn't go to theater school. My education is university. But after I finished university and had my BA, I went to England to audition for theater schools because I could go there because I was British born. I have a British passport. And I was successful, but I decided that in actual fact, for me, I was kind of chickening out of diving into the business. Like, going to a theater school felt a little bit like I was just kind of putting it off and wanting to play it safe. And so I took a chance and didn't go to theater school. Having said that, now that I'm my age now and my kids are grown and taking care of themselves, I have a real desire to go back to England with my husband, Oliver, who is also an actor and who could work in England as well because his dad is British. I have a desire to just go back, see what happens. You know, I love the British theater scene so much. Also the British film and TV scene where they really honor older women. But yeah, I would love, love, love to, you know, even for a year, just give it a go, see what happens. Wouldn't that be thrilling?
So besides being in plays, you have had some on-screen experience. According to your IMDb profile, it looks like a TV movie called The Men in the Attic was your major on-screen debut. Was that your debut, or did you have other on-screen roles prior to that?
You know, it's hard for me to remember the chronological order of all of that, but definitely, you know, The Man in the Attic was something that was quite early on in my career, because I want to say it was like 1994 or something like that. You know, the exciting thing about that one is that I got to work with Neil Patrick Harris, and this was, you know, not long after he had done Doogie Howser, and I used to always joke that I got to kiss Doogie Howser because I was playing his pseudo love interest in it. But it was, I think that probably was my first larger kind of situation on a film set. I didn't know how to work it at all. I was so green. But Neil Patrick Harris was really kind. Ann Archer was really kind. I remember doing a scene with Ann Archer and I forgot my lines. And I stopped. And the shock on her face that I had stopped, because in film and TV land, you can just keep going. And even if the words are not quite right, you can do another take. But coming from the theater world, I was like, nope. I screwed up a line. Now, obviously, if I'm, you know, on stage in front of an audience and I mess a line, I know how to navigate that. But with the camera in front of me, I just made the assumption that I got it wrong. I'm going to stop. We can do it again. But it was more theatrical in a way, in that I could have just kept going and there may have been some aspect of it that they could keep, you know, but because I stopped, the whole thing stopped. And then, you know, also with Anne, she delivered a line and I knew it wasn't the right line because it was a cue line for me, but like her grace and integrity and just keeping going with it really offered me a lesson in how to navigate this crazy, weird, unknown world of film and TV to me. She was very gracious.
When it comes to getting on-screen roles, it helps to have an agent to land those roles. Did you find it hard to find an agency that would accept you as a client?
That's a great question. And, you know, I've had a few agents over my time. And certainly early on in my career, I was with an agent who loves film and TV, obviously. And, you know, said the words, yes, we absolutely love that you love theater, but in actual fact, that wasn't quite true. And it was a relationship that ended up not continuing because it was clear that my priority will always be theater. And that agent came to realize that that was really true for me and that it wasn't worth it for them. So I appreciate that that happened. It was a bit hurtful at the time. But, you know, as I get older and I have no regrets about my career, and the agent that I am with now really honors my experience in the theater world. And I have to say as well that the film and TV industry has changed a lot, and there is a greater honor for theater actors now in film and TV than there was when I started, yikes, almost, not quite, but really close to 40 years ago. So the industry itself has changed. So yes, there was some difficulty finding an agent for a while based on my desire to continue in theater. But now it's great.
Now, some Canadian 90s kids will recognize you from Polka Dot Shorts. You played the librarian in that show, as well as the voice of Marigold. How did that role come about?
That was just a really delicious and delightful audition that I landed. And the original airing of Polka Dot Shorts was, I was a storyteller on screen. And I had a group of children around me, and I would open up a book and start to tell the story, and it would segue to the live action characters acting out the story. But in that first iteration, I was all the voices because I was the storyteller. So I got to do all of the voices, which was an extraordinary and delightful job to have. And so I did all of those stories. I did it for a few seasons. And then TVO smartly wanted to sell it to different markets. And so they didn't need to see this person on screen. And so it just became the live action characters. And they wanted different voice actors to take over. So I maintained my role as Marigold, which was super fun, but got to work with all these other fantastic voice actors, none of which I ever got to see or record with, but certainly got to hear, which was really fun. So I got to do those shows twice in a way. It was delightful. I'm a teacher as well, and I was actually reading the stories, and yes, you know, eventually it would go into the recording, but I would get to start to read the stories, and sometimes, depending on what the director wanted, sometimes we would pick up scenes where I was in the middle of reading the stories and getting to see the kids. But hanging out with kids, reading stories out loud, I mean, that's a dream job. It was so great.
That was a very common thing to do in the 90s, especially for kids' TV, is that they would have a narrator and then they would go into the live action portion of the story. You know, that was the case on shows like Shining Time Station or Theodore Tugboat, and of course Polka Dot Shorts back when it was on TVO. And it must have been really cool to be a part of Canadian pop culture by taking part in that show.
You know, it didn't even occur to me, you know, that it was as big as it was. I was very grateful for the job. I had so much fun. I loved the director. I loved the producer. I loved being at TVO. They treated me so well. And it wasn't until, you know, later on when people, especially when it was still, you know, me on screen. But even when I went, I ended up going back to school to get my Bachelor of Education in my mid-40s. And I was, you know, in classes, had colleagues that were that much younger than me. And they remembered me on screen. And it became, it was really fun to be kind of a star. I had no idea. I can be quite naive sometimes.
So when you stopped playing Deborah the librarian and you then did the actual voice of Marigold, how did you come up with Marigold's voice? She has a very sing-songy, like a little girl kind of voice.
She really does. Well, I mean, part of it was, you know, when I first started and I was doing all of the voices, I was working hard to differentiate them, make them as you know, very different as possible. But I wish I could remember the name of the amazing physical actor who embodied Marigold. But her, the way that she used that suit, that puppet, really kind of gave me a very clear picture of how to voice her. Marigold with her beautiful orange hair and her shaking her head and love of laughter. I have quite a high-pitched little giggle, and so it was, it kind of felt natural to use my own giggle, but ratcheted up, like higher and a bit more kind of quirky. And the way that the script was written, you know, her, one of her catchphrases was okie dokie. And so it just felt like a song to me to go okie dokie. I can't even hit those high notes anymore that I used to do for Marigold.
Well, that was pretty close, though.
Well, thank you. But she was a high-pitched girl, and I do remember, you know, because I doing voice work, I physicalize it too. I can't just sit still behind the microphone. There's a lot of movement, and I do remember feeling quite physically tired after playing around and hanging out with Miss Marigold for a while.
And it was a fun show as well. Pokeroo's pet Bibble, whatever the heck that was, always made me laugh when I was a kid.
Right? I know. And the producer of the show, Jed, oh my gosh, Drakeford, you should know all these names, but I it's been a while. Anyway, the producer of the show, Jed, who is this marvelous person, he was the voice of Bibble, and he would literally put his finger in his mouth between his lips and blah, 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 blah. But he had a quality to it that just was delightful. It was so much fun.
Yeah, Bibble kind of looked like those spiky balls that kids used to play with in the 90s. I had one of those.
Yes, yes, exactly, exactly. How smart of them to really sort of zero in on that.
Yeah, speaking of the 1990s, another series that you were involved in was Sailor Moon. I think that was one of the first major anime shows to premiere in North America.
I wasn't quite aware at the time just how huge Sailor Moon was. I had a very small little bit part. I think I did maybe 5 or 6 episodes. But what was so fun and hilarious about the role I played Fisheye, and I auditioned and got the role, and we were, dubbing it, I guess, from the original language to English. And anyway, so I got the role, and I started doing this character voice, and unbeknownst to me and to all, actually, Fisheye at one point takes off their shirt and is revealed to be a man. And nobody knew. And so I had a more feminine quality to my voice. And then during the revelation of who Fisheye actually is, I just started to slowly in that episode lower my voice and continue on as if Fisheye had been putting on this higher voice. Luckily, at that time, I had quite a range, so I could manipulate my own voice. But it was, I remember getting the call from the producer going, so when you come in, we've got a bit of a surprise. And yeah, it was hilarious. But also, what a delicious kind of opportunity to, you know, maintain the integrity of the character vocally, but be true to what the actual story was. Because I didn't have the opportunity to view all of the episodes. If I had, like prior to recording them, if I had, I probably would have made a different choice for the vocal quality going in. But what a delicious kind of surprise to be able to explore this character up here, who then in within one episode gets to segue down here. And then I think I had another, at least another one episode in the lower vocal quality. It was fun.
Now, most people probably recognize you as Charlotte from A History of Violence, the damsel in distress in that movie. It must have been an incredible experience to work alongside Viggo Mortensen, better known as Aragorn.
You know, I don't do a lot of film and TV, and to land that role in that piece and with David Cronenberg directing it and his, yeah, he... First of all, David Cronenberg, every actor should be lucky enough, to work with him. He is an extraordinary storyteller, as we know, and a kind, kind man who loves actors. He loves what we can bring to the table. And that was clear from day one. And then getting to work with Viggo Mortensen, who also is just such a genuine artist and so kind. And I will never forget being so nervous on day one. And we were in Millbrook shooting the diner scenes, and it was my first day. And I'm standing there quite shy and nervous. And Viggo came directly up to me and Jerry Quigley, who played the cook in that diner scene, and Viggo came up to us, shook our hands, introduced himself, and said, the diner set is over here, let's go sit in the bench and just, you know, shoot the breeze. And so we went into the diner set, sat in a booth, and just started chatting. And Viggo was so interested in both of us, wanted to know our background, delighted that I came from a theater background, wanted to know more about that, was so interested in Jerry's story, and he told stories as well. But the thing that really stuck with me is his interest in us and his desire to get to know us, because for the storytelling in the movie, we're all old friends. We have all grown up together in this small town, and we know each other so well. And when I viewed the movie and saw that scene, I thought, that plays out. You know, you can see how comfortable we are with each other. And a lot of the that diner scene felt like improvisation, because we were just shooting the breeze. We were just having a great time. And I will never forget the kindness of Mr. Mortensen. He was just a darling, a real gem.
Yeah, most of that movie, in fact, the majority of it, I think, was filmed in Canada and Southern Ontario, but they pretended that it was Indiana and Pennsylvania, I think.
Yeah, I mean, to my recollection, all of the diner stuff was in Millbrook, Ontario. There might have been an exterior or something in Toronto. That I can't quite remember. It was a long time ago, over 20 years ago now. But yeah, the diner in Millbrook was where we shot most of the stuff.
I remember reading somewhere that A History of Violence was one of, and quite possibly the last major Hollywood movie to be released on VHS. That's a bit of trivia that I read. And when I watched the movie for the first time, I knew that it was filmed in Canada, so it was fun to watch the movie to see if they accidentally, you know, shot anything that might be Canadian. Like, I noticed a Home Hardware sign once and a Canadian speed limit sign that they forgot to take out, which there's nothing wrong with that. I just thought it was funny that...
That's so funny.
It was there.
But I also wonder, you know, David Cronenberg is so smart, and I wondered if it is his little homage to Canada, too. You know, like, just sneaking in a little Home Hardware sign just to go, this is Canadian. I don't know. I just wonder about that.
So was that your first major Hollywood film, or were there other Hollywood films prior to that?
Oh, dear. That was my first and pretty much my only. I haven't done big, you know, films. I've done a little bit more TV stuff. I've done some, you know, TV movies, that kind of thing. But that is really my big one. I got to spend 10 days on set with beautiful David and beautiful Vigo. And so, you know, if that's the only one I ever do, lucky me.
So you live in Toronto now, and I assume that you've done a lot of plays in Toronto over the years?
I certainly have. Yeah, my career has taken me all across the country. I've done every province except for two, and I'm still working on them. But I would say that 50% of my work is in Toronto and 50% is out of town. That's actually changed a little bit in the last couple of years, kind of post-COVID. But I've done a lot of plays in Toronto. And for almost 20 years, I was affiliated with an indie theater company called ARC. And for the last 4 years of my time with ARC, I was the artistic producer. So I'd love to keep my hand in the theater scene in Toronto. But I also recognize that there's a lot of astonishing theater that happens all the way across the country. And I'm about to go out to Victoria, BC, to do a show at the Belfry Theatre. And I've been to Victoria, but I've never worked out there. And so I'm so excited that I get to explore that part of the country too. It's always so fascinating to me to see what different parts of the country are interested, what stories they're are interested in, what stories they're interested in telling, what is resonating with all the many, many communities that are out there wanting theater. I've been able to go up to Sudbury. I think I've done 7 or 8 shows up there now, and getting back up there is almost like going home because it's so close to Espanola. And I remember growing up in Espanola. I don't know if you did as well, Blake, but I loved going to the Sudbury Theater Center and seeing shows. And it was, you know, it was a professional theater up there so close to my hometown. So it was exciting.
Yeah, I did go to the Sudbury Theater Center about half a dozen times. And every time I went there, they always put on a really good show. And I live in Halifax now. And here in the Maritimes, there's a huge theater scene, you know, in Charlottetown, Halifax, you know, pretty much everywhere there's some kind of a theater, you know, just a little theater, you know, could be, yes, you know, a small town, could be a major theater in a small town, could be something like ELT, you name it.
Yes, yes, exactly, exactly. Nova Scotia actually is one of my two provinces I haven't worked in, so I'm working towards it. And then perhaps I'll meet you in person.
Yeah, and if you do appear in a play in Halifax, I'll be sure to get tickets.
Oh, yes, please. Yes, yes. It is really, really exciting. I worked in Prince Edward Island, but it wasn't in Charlottetown. I was up in North Rustico. I believe a theater company up there is now called Watermark, but at the time it was called the Montgomery Theater that I worked there. And it's so exciting that these smaller places have these vital and exciting little theater scenes. I don't mean to say little in a, you know, diminishing way at all, just that they're simply smaller. but the vitality is not smaller. It's really exciting.
Well, very often small theaters have big surprises, and you know they turn out to be the best most of the time.
That can happen. That's very, very true. And it's always exciting to learn too that, you know, people who are working a lot in the arts come from these small towns. And so that, you know, spark has to start somewhere. So, yeah.
I noticed on your Facebook profile picture, you're holding a guitar. Have you been playing music for a long time as well?
Oh, The short answer is no. That picture was taken actually up in Sudbury, at one of their spaces called the Refettorio, and it was for a promotional shot for a show that I did here in Toronto with a company that I used to run, and the show was called Rockabye. And in the play, I'm playing an aging rock star trying to make a comeback. And so we needed to do these promo shots, but I was out of town. I was up in Sudbury. And so I recruited a wonderful photographer up there, and we took those shots. And so that's the photo. I love that photo, but it is not an accurate depiction of who Deb Draper is. I wish I was a musician. You know, I'm about to turn 60, and I actually think, hey, maybe now's the time that I learn how to play something. I have had to play instruments in shows. I remember way back in 2010, the dearly missed Joseph Ziegler hired me to be in the show Waiting for the Parade, and my character plays the piano and has to play seven different wartime songs and sing and speak monologues as she's playing, and I'd never touched a piano in my life. And Mike Ross, who's the musical director on that show, taught me how to play these seven songs. Now, I can't read music, so we had music up on the piano as part of the set deck, but I couldn't read it. And I had to, and Mike had transposed all the songs into just chords. So I had to memorize these chords and play these chords. If I messed up on the piano, I didn't know how to fix it because I don't know piano theory. But I would just play these chords, and my poor family, I was practicing them over and over and over again, these seven songs over and over again. But because I did grow up in a musical family, my mom being a gospel singer, music has been part of my life all the time. There was a lot of us growing up. I had six siblings, and so we all had to choose our one thing, and I chose ballet, which I don't regret at all. But I never got to experience music. My parents just couldn't afford to give me all the lessons that I wanted. And but I've been able to explore it a little bit in my career through people like Mike Ross, who lets me, you know, mess around, and also teaches me in such a way that I had confidence and could successfully play these seven songs on a piano and sing. And if I messed up, I would just sing louder.
Have you ever thought about writing your own stage play or screenplay?
It's interesting that you should say that. Yes, is the short answer. I do have a desire to write a story. I think it probably is a play, but I don't know yet. But I also haven't even begun the writing. That's part of something that I actually am wanting to start this year in 2026. It has to do with my family, and it has to do with growing up in Northern Ontario. And while we were up there, this would be, you know, the late 70s into the 80s. And we adopted two Indigenous kids from up there. And, you know, I was a kid. I certainly wasn't aware of all of the politics involved, but definitely am aware of that now, what that means, you know, for a white family to adopt Indigenous children and their huge, huge stories. And I have a curiosity about writing some of that down and see where that might lead.
What's the biggest piece of advice that you could give to an aspiring actor or actress that might be struggling to find work?
That question makes me think of, again, the much-loved and much-missed Goldie Semple. I was an apprentice at Stratford in 1989, and Goldie was there being her wonderful star self and so kind and so gracious. And she gave me a piece of advice that I have never forgotten and I hang on to still to this day, having been in the business for almost 40 years. And she, because I was concerned about, I hadn't been asked back to the festival and I was worried about my career. And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, Deb, we'll all work again." And it was just the confidence and surety of that statement that made me think, oh, yeah, we will. It may not be exactly how we imagine it would be, but our artistic selves will find a way to get out. You know, besides the whole you gotta love it and all of that, it just being really honorable to your own self and your own truth and your own voice, and remembering that if Goldie Semple can say, oh, I'll work again, then we all can. Rest assured that we will.
I had a really fun time talking with you this week. Thank you so very much for joining us, and I wish you the best of luck going forward.
Thank you so much, Blake. What a pleasure to speak with you, too. Thanks so much for having me on, and I hope we meet in person someday.
And that was Canadian actress and educator Deborah Drakeford. I'm Blake Crash Priddle, and remember, here at The Medley, we're all kinds of different.